open up to Revelation, concluding chapter 14 this evening. You remember chapter 14 was part of the vision that began back in chapter 12, where John saw a great sign appear in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun. And of course, we identified the woman as Israel, and Satan's attempt or attack on the child of the woman to try to thwart the coming of the Messiah, the one who was promised to crush the head of the serpent. And he couldn't get the child, so he goes after the woman. He couldn't get the woman because she's protected, and so he goes after the rest of her offspring. And we see that in chapter 13, where the dragon comes. He's standing on the sand of the seashore, and there's the beast and the false prophet, or the second beast. And the whole program is instituted toward the rest of her offspring. And we identified that rest of her offspring primarily as the 144,000. It was those who were victorious, those who were sealed by God. And then at the beginning of 14, we saw that chapter 14 is divided up into three scenes. The first scene was verses 1 through 5, where we saw the victory of the Lamb and the victory of the saints, the Lamb standing on Mount Zion with Him 144,000. And this is the same 144,000 that was sealed earlier in Revelation. We see it's a select group among a larger group of saints. These are saints who have been martyred under the rule and reign of the beast. And they're a select group because these have endured the dragon and the beast. They've been faithful through it all. And then we saw the second scene was basically a call to worship. There's the scene of the victorious saints, the victorious Lamb, then the call to worship God. It's essentially the last chance to reconsider, do you really want to follow the beast? Do you really want to receive this mark? Do you really want to worship and buy into this program? Because these are going to be the consequences of worshiping the beast. There's going to be you're going to drink the wine of the wrath of God, which is mixed in full strength. It's undiluted, unmitigated, intensified wrath with the cup of His anger. And then in verses 12 through 13, there was some encouraging words of encouragement to the saints to persevere. But then we come to the third scene in verse 14. Let me just read this. And I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and sitting on the cloud was one like a son of man, having a golden crown on his head, and a sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came out of the temple, crying out with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, put in your sickle and reap, because the hour to reap has come, because the harvest of the earth is ripe. And he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was reaped. And another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven, and he also had a sharp sickle. And another angel, the one who has power over fire, came out from the altar, and he called with a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, saying, put in your sharp sickle, and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, because her grapes are ripe. And the angel swung his sickle to the earth, and gathered the clusters from the vine of the earth, and threw them into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood came out from the winepress up to the horses' bridles for a distance of 200 miles. So here, so we see chapter 14 is, as we've said, is all proleptic. It's looking to a future event and describing it as though it has happened. And it's really providing background information for the last judgments that we've read, are going to read about, the seven bowl judgments. Remember, with the first seven judgments were the seven seal judgments, and the seventh seal was the trumpet judgments, and we had the trumpet judgments. And then the seventh trumpet is the seven bowl judgments. But between the trumpet and the bowl judgments, we've had chapters 12, 13, and 14 showing us and preparing us as to why the intensity of these final judgments, these final bowl judgments. Now, to kind of help us think through and what exactly verses 14 through 20 are dealing with, I think it will help to look at a couple of Jesus' parables. It will help clarify a lot of what we're going to be reading. But look first of all in Matthew 13. In Matthew 13, Jesus told the parable of the wheat and the tares. In verse 24 through 30 of Matthew 13, says he presented another parable to them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while men were sleeping, his enemy came and sowed tares also among the wheat and went away. But when the wheat sprang up and bore grain, then the tares became evident also. And the slaves of the landowner came and said to him, 'Sir, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have tares?' And he said to them, 'An enemy has done this.' And the slave said to him, 'Do you want us then to go and gather them up?' But he said, 'No, lest while you are gathering up the tares, you may root up the wheat with them. Allow both to grow together until the harvest, and in the time of the harvest, I will say to the reapers, first, gather up the tares, bind them in bundles to burn them up, but gather the wheat into my barn.'" And then in verse 36 through 43, Jesus explains this parable of the wheat and tares. Verse 37, he answered and said, "The one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. And the field," and this is important, "the field is the world." Now, how often have you heard this parable explained, and I've heard it a bunch, that in the wheat and the tares, it's referring to the church. You got tares among the wheat within the church, and we can't go and start pulling out the tares without pulling up the wheat as well. So we just kind of, we can't judge anybody. We can't say, this is good, this is wrong. We can't go in and tell people and identify people as tares versus wheat. But yet Jesus said in verse 26, the tares became evident. So this is not talking about the church. The field is the world. It's the world, not the church. So this is not the rapture. This is the second coming. "And as for the good seed, these are the sons of the kingdom. The tares are the sons of the evil one. The enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age. The reapers are angels. Therefore, just as the tares are gathered up and burned with fire, so shall it be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send forth His angels. They will gather out of His kingdom all stumbling blocks. Those who commit lawlessness will cast them into the furnace of fire. In that place there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father." So this is the final judgment. This is the final gathering of the wicked. This is the end of the age. This is the second coming of Christ, is what he's describing here, not the rapture. Another parable is in Matthew 24. Matthew 24, the disciples have asked Jesus, "What will be the signs of your coming and the end of the age?" And so Jesus explains to them all these things leading up to the tribulation period. But then in verse 36, he says, "But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven nor the Son, but the Father alone. For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For as in those days which were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, they were marrying, giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark. Now, when Jesus said it would be just like the days of Noah, he's not referring to the licentiousness of the times or the wickedness of the times. He's talking about the unpreparedness. They're eating, they're drinking, they're marrying, giving in marriage. They're just going on with life as normal, as though nothing is wrong. So he's emphasizing the unpreparedness of the people. And they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. Took them away where? In judgment, right? Took them away in judgment. So shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Then there shall be two men in the field. One will be taken. Taken where? In judgment. One will be left. This is not the rapture being described here. And so often you will hear this passage used as a teaching of the rapture. This is not teaching of the rapture. This is the second coming of Christ. Because they're being taken away in judgment. Who's being taken away? The wicked. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken. One will be left. Therefore, be on the alert. For you do not know which day your Lord is coming. But be sure of this, that if the head of the house had known it, what time of the night the thief was coming, he would have been on the alert and would not have allowed his house to be broken into. For this reason, you be ready too. For the Son of Man is coming in an hour when you do not think he will. So Jesus is emphasizing preparedness, readiness for his coming, being faithful, persevering to the end, not getting sucked into the world system. And here, we see in verses 14 through 20, essentially a working out of what Jesus told in these parables, the second coming of Christ. So, at this time in the history of the earth, we're looking toward the end of the second half of the tribulation period. There's probably very few true Christians still alive on earth at this period of the tribulation. Most will have been martyred by now, killed by now. And then John says in verse 14, "And I looked." So again, introducing a new scene. But then he adds, "And behold," just like he did over in verse 1, drawing special emphasis to this particular scene. "Behold, a white cloud, and sitting on the cloud was one like a Son of Man." Now, John here is drawing a strong allusion to Joel. Joel 3, 12 and 13, as well as Daniel 7, 13 and 14. In Joel, Joel chapter 3, verse 12 and 13. Because John sees one sitting on a cloud, the Son of Man, having a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. Joel 3, 12 through 13, "Let the nations be aroused and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, tread, for the winepress is full. The vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes, in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision." And then also, again, a strong allusion to Daniel chapter 7, verses 12. Especially in verse 13, "I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a Son of Man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him, and to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed." So here we're seeing the coming of Christ, the second coming. It's not the rapture. And this is what Jesus is referring to in Matthew 24. in Matthew 27, verse 64. And when he says, like a son of man, one like a son of man, strong reference to Daniel. It's also, John has also used the same terminology to describe Jesus earlier in Revelation chapter 1, verse 13. In the middle of the lampstands, one like a son of man, clothed in a robe reaching to the feet. So he's used the same terminology already to refer to Jesus. This is the Messiah. It's not an angel. And he's having a golden crown on his head. Now the crown here is Stephanon or Stephanos. It's the victor's crown. And so Jesus is seen as coming victorious over all his enemies. Just essentially the same picture that was painted in 14 verse 1. The Lamb standing on Mount Zion. He's victorious. And he has a sharp sickle. The same word can also be translated swift. You know, if it's sharp, it's going to cut swift. And this word sickle appears 8 times in the New Testament. 7 of those times right here in verse 14, verses 14 through 20. And always it refers to a time of harvest. So we see the Messiah prepared to execute judgment. It's a picture of Jesus. And unfortunately, it's a picture of Jesus that is largely ignored by the church today. How much of the church today, go around and read church signs. You know, that's kind of a little pastime, I guess I have when I drive around, look at the messages on these message boards. You can tell a lot about church by the message on their message board. But this is a picture of Jesus. The Jesus coming in judgment. Coming to judge the ungodly. Coming to judge the wicked. Coming to pour out His wrath on an unbelieving world. That's a picture you don't hear very often in the church today. Instead, it's all love, 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 love. This indiscriminate love. The love that pays no attention to right or wrong. It's just unmitigated love. Love, love. Jesus is all love. No mention of a wrathful Jesus. An angry Jesus. One coming to execute severe judgment. But here, we see a picture of Jesus that is very rarely painted in the church today. But then John sees another angel, verse 15, and another angel. This is the fourth of the 6 angels that are in chapter 14. We saw 3 of them in verses 6 through 13 before. And now here are the other 3. This is the fourth one, the fourth of the 6. The first 3 announced the coming judgment. We saw that there was in verse 6, there was verse 8, and verse 9. These angels were announcing the coming judgment. Whereas this fourth announces it's time to execute judgment. The time has arrived. Remember what Jesus said in Matthew 24? No one knows the day or the hour. Not the angels in heaven, not the Son of Man. Only the Father knows the exact hour of the time of the judgment to be executed. Well, now it's come. The time has arrived. And so this another angel came out of the temple. Well, what temple? Well, probably the... We saw a temple in chapter 11, verse 19. The temple of God, which is in heaven, was opened, and the ark of His covenant appeared in His temple. Flashes of lightning, sounds and peals of thunder, and an earthquake and a great hailstorm. See, that came, remember, at the end of the announcement of the seventh trumpet. And the seventh trumpet is going to usher in the bowl judgments. And so we see all these scenes of judgment, the flashes of lightning, sounds and peals of thunder, an earthquake and a great hailstorm. Well, here we have the angel coming out of the temple, the place from which the pronouncements of judgment are made. It's God's dwelling place, the heavenly temple. Again, this is where God decrees His judgment. Chapter 15, verse 6. The seven angels who had the seven plagues came out of the temple clothed in linen. And in verse 8, the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from His power. And no one was able to enter the temple until the seven plagues of the seven angels. So once they start going, once these seven bowl judgments, God is going to be unapproachable. His wrath is being poured out. And in chapter 16, verse 1, I heard a loud voice from the temple say to the seven angels, well, if it's coming from the temple, whose voice is that? God's. Heard a loud voice from the temple saying to the seven angels, go and pour out the seven bowls of wrath. And then in verse 17 of chapter 16, the seventh angel poured out his bowl upon the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple from the throne saying, it is done. Judgment's completed. So here, this angel's coming out of the temple with the pronouncement, crying with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, put in your sickle and reap. Because the hour to reap has come. It's here. Because the harvest of the earth is ripe. This is the harvest of rebellious, unbelieving people. It's the harvest separating the wheat from the tares. Now, something we need to see here, and this is some theology here. We've been studying on Sunday morning, looking at the Gospel of John. If you turn over to John chapter 1. The Apostle John tells us several things about Jesus. He's trying to convey, actually, John's Gospel is the only one of the four Gospels that explicitly states Jesus is God. And of course, he does it right from the very beginning. In the beginning was the Word. Doesn't say the Word began, He just was. He always is, always existed. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. So we see two separate, distinct beings here. There's the Word and there's God. Now this goes against what many cults teach. It's a view called modalism, that there's just one God and He expresses Himself in different modes. Sometimes He's God the Father, sometimes He's God the Son, sometimes He's God the Holy Spirit, but there's not a triune God, three distinct persons. Well, here we see the Word was with God, two distinct entities. And the Word was God. Now, we're not teaching, again, here that the Father is the Son and the Son is the Father. That, again, would be modalism. The Word was God. He was in the nature of God, the essence of God. Remember what Jesus told Philip when Philip said, show us the Father in John chapter 14. And Jesus said, have I been so long with you that you don't recognize me? If you've seen me, you have seen the Father. We're the same essence. Our Hebrews chapter 1 verse 3 says that Jesus is the exact representation of His nature. So He is the essence of God. So that John there in John chapter 1, verse 1 and 2 shows the relationship of Jesus to the Godhead. He is the Word. He is God, but He's not God the Father. He's with God. He's a separate entity. but He is God. He has the essence and the nature of God. But then in verse 3, 4, and 5, and this is where I'm getting at here, is John shows the role of Jesus in the Godhead. All things came into being by Him or through Him, and apart from Him, nothing came into being that has come into being. So John says it both positively and negatively here. Everything that exists came into being by Him, by the Word. Well, that excludes Jesus as being a created being, like the Jehovah's Witnesses say, because a created being can't create itself, but all things came into being by Him, and apart from Him, nothing came into being that's come into being. From the microbe to the archangel, nothing exists. There was no pre-existing material that Jesus worked with. Everything came into being. So Jesus' role in the Godhead, He is the active agent in creation. And then in verse 4, in Him was life, and the life was the light of men. In other words, Jesus is the active agent in revelation, the revelation of God to man. And then in verse 5, and the light shines in the darkness did not comprehend it. In other words, Jesus is the active agent in the redemption of man. And now, in Revelation chapter 14 here, we see Jesus is the active agent in judgment. Within the Godhead, God plans what is planned and purposed in the mind of God. The Son is the active agent in bringing it to pass. He carries it out, and including the judgment. Including the judgment. It's in John chapter 5. In John chapter 5, Jesus said, verse 26, for just as the Father has life in Himself, even so He gave the Son to have life in Himself, and He gave Him authority to execute judgment. Why? Because He is the Son of Man. It's the second person of the Godhead. So He is the active agent. He has been given the authority to execute judgment. And so here we see Jesus as this active agent. It's the hour to reap has come. Why? Because the harvest of the earth is ripe. Just kind of getting back to verse 7. Fear God and give Him glory because the hour of His judgment has come. It's here. Now the word, it's interesting here, the word ripe here. Because the harvest of the earth is ripe is in the passive voice. In other words, it's been made ripe. See, God has a timetable. God has a timetable. And everything is moving and working toward His timetable. And He will bring about His judgment in His time when it's ready. See, in Genesis chapter 15, when the Abrahamic covenant is ratified, remember Moses sees the burning torch moving between the pieces of the animal, and God is ratifying the Abrahamic covenant. God says something interesting here in verse 16, talking about how the nation of Israel will be in bondage and slavery for 400 years. But then He says in verse 16, then in the fourth generation, they shall return here. For the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. You see, the nation of Israel was God's instrument of judgment on the Amorite, on the Canaanite nation. Why did Israel go into bondage into Egypt? It was to insulate them. It was to protect them from all the iniquity and the idolatry and the wickedness that was going on in the land of Canaan while they were in Egypt. And then once God brought them out of Egypt, back to the land of promise, they were used as God's instrument of judgment on the Amorites, on the Canaanites, on the people living in that land. Why? Because their iniquity at the time Abraham was alive was not yet complete. But when they went in, it was. It was ripe. The harvest of the earth is ripe. There's a time when God says, enough is enough. The cup of wrath is full. Peter gives us some interesting insight into the reaction of the world to this type of teaching concerning the wrath of God. 2 Peter chapter 3. There's three types of arguments here, really, that are used by false teachers, by those who are against the second coming of the judgment of God. In verse 3 of 2 Peter 3, know this first of all, that in the last days, mockers will come with their mocking. So the first thing they do is ridicule. And these are coming from within the church, not outside the church, from within the church. They're ridiculing. God's not going to come again. He's certainly not going to come for judgment and punish people just because they don't believe in Jesus. But then they come with their mocking, following after their own lusts. So they're motivated by immorality. They're motivated by personal pleasure. They're going to mock and saying, where is the promise of His coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation. So they use the argument of uniformitarianism. Everything's the way it's always been. Nothing's changing. Everything's always the way it is. The present is the key to the past. But then Peter says, for when they maintain this, it escapes their notice. And in the Greek, there's the word willingly. It escapes their notice willingly. That by the word of God, the heavens existed long ago. The earth was formed out of water. And it was destroyed. God did judge the world before, didn't He? It was in the flood. But that's denied. That's denied today. The concept of a worldwide flood is believed by relatively few people within the church today. We try to accommodate naturalistic science instead because we don't want to be accountable to a God who's going to judge. But all judgment is given to the Son. And so He's in verse 16, He who sat on the clouds swung His sickle over the earth, and the earth was reaped. So here it's made very clear what is being judged. Who is being judged? The earth. The harvest of the earth is ripe. He swung His sickle over the earth, and the earth was reaped. That's pretty brief statement. Pretty abrupt. The earth was reaped. Well, the brevity is there for a reason, emphasizing the suddenness of the judgment. Remember Jesus said, I'm coming like a thief. Like a thief. He even says it again over in verse 15 of chapter 16. Just a parenthetical statement right after the sixth bowl. Behold, I'm coming like a thief. Blessed is the one who stays awake and keeps his garments, lest he walk about naked and men see his shame. So let's keep persevering. Don't give in. So this is the Messiah's role, Jesus' role, an active agent of God in judgment. He is the active agent of the Godhead. Then we see the angelic role. Remember Jesus in the parable of the wheat and the tares said that the angels would go in and harvest. The reapers are the angels, he said. Verse 17, another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven. And he also had a sharp sickle. So he's coming out of the temple, the place from where the judgments are being pronounced, and he had a sharp sickle. And another angel, the one who has power over fire, came out from the altar. So who's this? Who's this other angel coming out from the altar? Well, we've seen him before. Chapter 8, verse 3 through 6. And another angel came. This is the opening of the seventh seal, which of course begins the trumpet judgments. Another angel came and stood at the altar, holding a golden censer, and much incense was given to him, that he might add it to the prayers of the saints upon the golden altar, which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints went up before God out of the angel's hands. Remember, these are prayers of the saints under the altar, crying out, how much longer, till you vindicate us. Verse 5, the angel took the censer, filled it with the fire of the altar, and threw it to the earth. There followed peals of thunder, sounds and flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. So again, instituting the judgment. See, we see the same angel, the one has power over the fire, coming out from the altar of incense. And he tells the angel with the sickle, put in your sharp sickle. Notice, when he told Jesus, put in your sickle, he just said, put in your sickle and reap. Here he says, put in your sharp sickle. Again, quick judgment. Executed quickly, swiftly, and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, because her grapes are ripe. Again, the hour has come. The harvest of the earth is ripe. Here we see the harvest are the grapes. The grapes are ripe. It's the fruit of the wicked people. A good tree can't bring forth bad fruit. A bad tree can't bring forth good fruit. A tree is known by its fruit. The vine of the earth produces evil fruit. And so, the wicked are reaped. See, God's people produce the fruit of righteousness. But this is impossible. It's impossible for the unsaved to produce the fruit of righteousness. Only bad fruit. Deuteronomy 32, Moses stated, which is 32 is the song of Moses, 32 and 33, speaking of the wicked, their vine is from the vine of Sodom and the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of poison, their clusters bitter. Their wine is the venom of serpents and the deadly poison of cobras. See, it's infectious. It's deadly. But here it's reached its ripeness. It's time for the harvest. So the angel swung his sickle to the earth and gathered the clusters from the vine of the earth and threw them in to the great winepress of the wrath of God. So this is all the enemies of God, all the unbelievers that are alive at this time, which is going to be the majority of the earth, are going to experience the wrath, unmitigated, undiluted, mixed in full measure, wrath of God. This imagery here comes straight from Isaiah 63, and it's picked up again in Revelation, in Revelation 19. But in Isaiah 63, verse 1, "Who is this who comes from Edom with garments of glowing colors from Bozrah? This one who is majestic in his apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength? It is I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Why is your apparel red and your garments like the one who treads in the winepress? I have trodden the wine trough alone, and from the peoples there was no man with me. I also trod them in my anger and trampled them in my wrath, and their lifeblood is sprinkled on my garments, and I stained all my raiment. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and my year of redemption is come. And I looked, and there was no one to help, and I was astonished, and there was no one to uphold. So my own arm brought salvation to me, and my wrath upheld me. And I trod down the peoples in my anger, and made them drunk in my wrath, and I poured out their lifeblood on the earth." So here, these are thrown, these wicked, that reet from the earth, they're thrown into the great winepress of the wrath of God. In Revelation 19, which then records the second coming, 19:15, "From his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may smite the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron, and he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God the Almighty." Again, it's also referring, making allusion to Lamentations 1:15. Well, what is this wrath of God? This is not eternal punishment in hell. It may include that. But what it's looking at is the bowl judgments. It's the coming bowl judgments. It's going to be a time of unprecedented earthly judgment, unprecedented bloodshed, unprecedented suffering and torment. Notice the wine press was trodden outside the city. So the city, what is the city here? Probably Jerusalem. Because Jerusalem is spared. Babylon's not going to be spared. This is not fallen. Fallen is Babylon. But here, the wine press was trodden outside the city. So where is this outside the city? Where's the location? Well, again, we read in Joel 3, 12 through 14, the Valley of Jehoshaphat. We also see in verse 16 of chapter 16, "They gathered them together to the place which in Hebrew is called Harmageddon." So, this, or also called the Valley of Megiddo, Valley of Megiddo, is another name for the garden or for the Valley of Armageddon. So it's just this massive outpouring of blood. The blood came out from the wine press up to the horses' bridles for a distance of 200 miles. Now this could just be hyperbole for just a massive slaughter as a result of God's wrath. But it could be fairly literal. It could be also a literal interpretation as this too, not just hyperbole, because the length of the valley of Armageddon or Megiddo is about this 200 miles. Literally, it's 1,600 stadia, and stadia is about 600 feet. And so it's close to 200 miles here. And the valley of Megiddo, or Armageddon, drains into the entire Jordan River system. And so if you have this massive amount of bloodshed, this blood draining into the river systems, it could be turned the water red. And just think of some of the battles in the Civil War. I used to read a lot of Civil War history. And there'd be accounts of men who would go to a stream after a battle to get a drink, and the water tasted like blood because there was so much. As a matter of fact, at the Battle of Shiloh, there's even a pond called Bloody Pond because it became so bloody with the blood of the men and the horses and the animals that were killed that the water was literally red and looked like blood and tasted like blood. So we're just looking at a time of intense bloodshed, intense carnage. I mean, this is just a terrible prospect here. This is the future of the world. This is the future of anybody who is separated from Christ, from every unbeliever. It's a terrible prospect, and it's the only expectation for an unbeliever, for somebody who is all caught up in this world, who wants to worship the beast, who wants to avoid persecution, who wants to hitch their wagon to this world instead of living in this world as though they're a stranger and alien. Now chapter 14, 12, 13, and 14 has set the stage. It's setting the tone for the final judgment of God's wrath, the seven bowls. Chapter 15, verse 1 says, I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels who had seven plagues, which are the last, because in them the wrath of God is finished. So this is telling us, it's setting the stage, and it's setting the tone for these final judgments. God's wrath is going to be finished, but it is going to be horrendous. So do we see why Revelation was written